Hi, Josh.
Hi there, Brink. How are you today? You've been on vacation someplace.
I've been away for a couple of weeks. I'm back and still don't apparently have my head completely in the game because I knew I had a Blogging Heads thing to tape today, but I left my Bluetooth sitting on the dresser, so I'm going old school right now.
You've got the phone to your ear, huh?
I've got my landline phone receiver up to my ear, which is not very aesthetically pleasing for the viewers, but I think at least as far as this half of the screen is concerned, the aesthetic stakes were pretty low to begin with. So.
That's right. That's right.
Let's soldier on.
Yeah. You're prettier than me. So, yeah. And speaking of pretty, we talked about Paris Hilton at the beginning last time. We did get a few negative comments.
Yes, some of our very serious viewers were
disappointed.
Yes.
And but.
So
but,
let's not do that again.
No, we're not going to do that again, but I thought we should, for the sake of a kind of gender balance, we should talk about some male airheads.
Okay.
This is not eye candy, but brain candy, and there were two examples of striking examples of this recently. One, you may have read in the Times about the very widespread distribution of a book called Atlas of Creation by someone named Harun Yahya, which I happen to have a copy of here.
Hold it up.
Yeah, I'm going to hold it up to the... It's a little hard, and I may have to apply for worker comp pay because it's 12 pounds, this book. I'm holding it up. You can't see it.
Yeah, I've heard about it. I'm apparently not in the select demographic that gets to receive these things, so have you poured through it?
It's really something. It's got holograms on the cover.
Cool.
It's got a CD labeled Fossils Have Discredited Evolution. And then it is fantastically, beautifully produced. I'm going to, for viewers who haven't seen it, I'm holding it up to the camera. These are extremely high-quality photographs for hundreds and hundreds of pages, 800 pages. And by the way, you won't be shocked to hear this, but this is labeled Volume 1, and it says someplace in the mailing that I got with it, I think it's the first of 7 volumes.
Excellent.
Yeah, this is all good news. Now, the thing about this is this cost somebody a huge amount of money to produce. I mean, it's really beautifully produced.
And isn't it Islamic?
This is Islamic creationism, yes.
Which I had never really heard of before.
I'm not shocked to hear that there is Islamic creationism.
No.
But it has not been a major part of the debate so far. But it is Islamic creationism. It's that the fossil record shows you that, today's creatures have been around for a very, very long time. This is someone who, as far as I can tell from looking at the book and reading some stuff about it, knows, and you'll have to pardon my language, I know some of the listeners don't like when I go this route, but who knows fuck all about, in fact, the cube root of fuck all, about science, biology, evolution, creation, knows how to produce a very beautiful book. But somebody spent both a huge amount of money producing this thing. This book would cost a couple of $100 in the bookstore, and also an enormous amount of intellectual energy generating this thing.
Doesn't this lend some credence to Dinesh D'Souza's crackpot recent book where he's urging American social conservatives and Islamists to band together and get their reactionary freak on together?
That's right, yes. This is the book that says that the culture, me,
yeah.
the,
well, you, and
you,
your pals.
You,
and
no,
your,
you too.
Yeah.
You know, this is part of your libertarian synthesis. It's really probably more directed at you that people like you and me, and there is a group there.
Yes.
We have disagreements, but we
are. We cause 9/11.
Yeah, we that's the second sentence in the book. I did have an offer from Dinesh D'Souza to publish a piece of it in Boston Review, and I was very enthusiastic about doing it until I started reading the thing, and I thought this is absolutely worse than off the wall. It's really terrible.
Just scandalous.
Really awful. Unfortunately, I did close the blinds before we started talking today. As I mentioned before, the Hoover Tower is within sight, and Dinesh D'Souza is a non-resident fellow at the Hoover Institution, which I think is unfortunate for Hoover. It really was a scandalous book.
I agree completely. Yeah. Well, we're on the subject of creationism, going back to that. I didn't get the book, as I mentioned, but while I was away on vacation, it just so happens that a former colleague of mine at Cato dropped by, and he must have been doing some sort of culture slumming tourism, because he apparently visited the Creationism Museum, and he left a nice souvenir cap, which I've just donned here, and I'll wear for a couple of seconds. The Creationism Museum is in Petersburg, Kentucky, which seems to be not too far from the Cincinnati airport. I looked up, there was a recent, it just opened, I think, in May, or anyway, there was a recent New York Times article about it, and it just seems extremely lavish, just like you said, that the production values of this effort are really top-notch, and I think the guy who did it was behind some of the rides at Universal Studios, and it's really looks, you know, sleek and well done, and yet, you know, at the bottom of it is,
it's nutty, crazy. I think crazy, but human comedy or something. I mean, to have invested the kind of time and energy in producing this thing, which is, you know, beautiful production values, but it's just absolutely, vacuous. But then, speaking of vacuous, we have on that note. Yes. Speaking of vacuous, I noticed this morning that the op-ed wars at the New York Times continue. There was a piece by Paul Krugman, in effect, although not by name, responding to David Brooks's column of a few days ago. This was the Bush v. Tolstoy column by David Brooks. In which, for about the first 75% of the op-ed, George Bush was the object of lavish praise, or what seemed to be lavish praise, for his
so unshakable in his high spirits and self-confidence.
Unshakable, exactly. And in the face, celebrating as if celebrating creationism, celebrating his ability to withstand all the evidence that things aren't going too well.
Yes.
Brooks tried to save himself at the end by saying maybe Tolstoy was right after all, and that all history is not the history of decisions by self-confident leaders.
Yeah, so the profile of Bush was sort of two parts. First, that he's got this theological faith that he's, you know, executing God's plan for liberating mankind.
Right.
And secondly, that he revels in being the leader and has a very sort of leader principle view of the way the world works. That if you mention a country to him, he thinks of the person who's currently in charge of that government, and that it all kind of boils down to that person's personality and whether he can look into his soul and see a good guy or a bad guy. And and it's just an incredible kind of cartoon caricature of the great man theory of history that seems to be, seems to be animating his approach to geopolitics.
And the thing that was striking about it was this came hard on the heels of the Lobster Summit, where Bush looked into Putin's soul.
Yes.
They had some good meals together, and no sooner did Putin go home than they were pulling out of the arms control treaty in Europe because of concerns about the missile shield. And then the embodiment of the Iraqi soul, the great leader there, Maliki, had just been saying, listen, we don't need you here. Americans can go home and we can take care of our own business. So I just thought, we've talked a little bit about David Brooks before. I do think that about 10% of the columns that he writes are really quite profound and insightful. Today's was a little off the wall, but 10% of our...
I didn't quite get what he was trying to accomplish there, and
today.
I thought perhaps.
Oh, yes.
Bush versus Tolstoy. With the ending on Tolstoy, that perhaps he was trying to kind of subtly indicate the profound misguidedness of Bush's self-confidence.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
I know that David has said, or I don't know if he wrote it or remarked it, that he at times has fears that Bush is a sleeper cell agent sent to discredit everything he, David Brooks, believes in. And he's doing a good job.
He is doing a good job. But, you know, it's I admire Tolstoy as much as the next guy, but the idea that you've got to go to as far as Tolstoy to have some worries about this guy, about George Bush, this is like really a stretch. And I suppose, you know, maybe what he was saying was that when he's in the presence of George Bush, he finds him such an attractive and compelling figure. He's so drawn by Bush's confident cheerfulness, and maybe
right.
so wishes that he had some of that confident cheerfulness himself, that he has to pull himself all the way to great Russian novelists in order to resist that.
I happened to read War and Peace last summer, and it's a trite thing to say, but it was one of the truly great reading experiences of my life, and in particular, just the masterful way in which he deconstructs Napoleon's pretensions and delusions that he is, the agent of destiny. I think Tolstoy goes too far, and that in fact it's clear that individuals' fateful decisions can be incredibly important. I don't think we would be in Iraq without the particular personality of George W. Bush.
That's right.
So
I happen to be on my commute between San Francisco and Palo Alto. I listened to books, and I did listen to Anna Karenina, which was after Ulysses, the second of the great books that I've listened to. The one I'm listening to now, though, actually is resonates even more with all of this, which is Don Quixote.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to think that it's all enchanters who are making the world look different.
But, you know, Brooks's sort of admitted, you know, susceptibility to the charisma of a self-confident politician is, well, it's very much a Washington disease. We all tend to think about horse races and politics and personalities and people in Washington start yawning and rolling their eyes very quickly when you're talking about wonkish stuff, impersonal forces and long-term trends. But they really do often have a lot more with what's going on than the stuff.
I wanted to I thought maybe we should say something about the David Brooks thing is because I think we always ought to resist two important forces in American politics. One is male bonding, which David Brooks was doing with George Bush, and the other is Fourth Estate suck up, which this seemed to me to be a particularly unseemly example of, and I didn't think it was redeemed by the references to Tolstoy. But maybe we should move on to smaller and lesser or bigger
and
better.
For segue purposes, we can actually move on to a political horse race in which, somehow or another by accident, a substantive policy discussion has broken out. And this is the kind of split or whatever debate emerging between John Edwards and Barack Obama on the issue of poverty. First of all, it's noteworthy, and I think I don't give a lot of credit to John Edwards about a lot of things, but I think it's to his credit to take an issue that truly is an important issue and an important problem in American life that doesn't get a lot of attention or hasn't received much sustained political attention in recent years, and bring it up to the top of national debate and encourage Obama for substantive and political reasons to respond. But at any rate, we're getting a kind of interesting discussion of what to do about intractable, multi-generational inner-city poverty. And I know that that this debate has played out in the pages of your magazine, Boston Review, not too long ago. And so I thought maybe you could tell us what they're arguing about and what the experts are having to say.
Well, we've had a couple of pieces in the review on this. The issue is you have, as you say, multi-generational, highly concentrated central city poverty. So you can't really talk about you know, there was a time when the poverty issue in the United States was an issue about rural poverty. I don't say that that issue has gone away. Of course, it hasn't. But the big poverty issue, I think, by general agreement, is the issue of concentrated poverty in central cities, which, of course, also has a substantial overlay of race.
Yes.
So, broadly speaking, there are two stylized ways of trying to address this issue. One is disperse the poor, and I'll say more about that in a second. That sounds like a bad, like a tendentiously bad description. I don't mean it that way. So one is disperse the poor. The other is to try to solve the problem in place. And as I understand it, again, stylizing greatly, Edwards is more in the disperse camp and Obama more in the address the problems in place. So the idea of the disperse camp is that you really can't break free from the sustained reproduction of concentrated central city poverty except by helping the people who are poor, low skill, low education, low skill, low job experience, spending too much time hanging around with friends who are in similar circumstances, can't deal with that issue except by enabling people who are poor to move out of concentrated central city poor neighborhoods.
Right.
And you could do that. There are some experiments through which where that's happened, one in Chicago in particular, and the results, there's a debate about it, but there seems to be some evidence that the results were not bad. If done right, meaning if you really took seriously the importance of dispersing people and getting them into decent neighborhoods and enabling them to move, et cetera, it would be a very, very expensive program. We had an article by Owen Fiss at Yale Law School about, so I don't know, 6 years ago in Boston Review about this, and then eventually there was a book that came out of it that was published by Princeton University Press with a lead article by Owen and a bunch of responses of people who were not very happy about the idea of population dispersion as a way of dealing with this issue. The alternative way of dealing with the issue is to go back to the idea that what you want to do is address these issues in place through some combination of dealing with the healthcare issue, dealing with the education issue, dealing with the training issue, dealing with the availability of jobs, and maybe through some self-sustaining logic, getting people to stop moving, you know, people who do have skills, who are relatively economically successful, get them to stop moving out of these neighborhoods and separating their fate off. This is one of these issues where it's very hard to figure out. It's a, as you say, it's an extremely important issue, and it's, I think it's pretty hard to say which of these is, you know, strategies is most likely to be effective.
As I recall, the kind of best social science out there doesn't offer a lot of support for the idea that the dispersion strategy is any kind of silver bullet.
Right, and of course, it doesn't. There's no silver bullet with the in-place strategy either. The problem with the dispersal strategy is, first of all, there have to be when you're not talking about a couple of thousand people from, you know, one city, but tens, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of people. It gets very expensive. You're going to get a lot of resistance from neighborhoods, and inevitably, you're not going to get everybody moved out. And so there's still going to be, with the dispersal strategy, some problem, as in the experiments, of a kind of creaming. The people who sign up for the programs are the ones who are most likely to succeed, the ones who are most ambitious. After all, they signed up for the programs. And what you're left, the population that you're left with is a population that really is the most... where the problems of poverty, education, skills, training, et cetera, health, et cetera, are the most difficult to deal with. So, and And it also, the dispersal strategy does really require that you think that there's no significant value in people, you know, living together in neighborhoods with people who they want to live with and trying to solve some problems through their own collective efforts and with assistance, of course.
Yes. But,
so I think there's a kind of patronizing insult in the dispersal strategy, but, on the issue of success, I don't think anybody can express a great deal of confidence about which one of these is
going. I did an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal just a couple of weeks ago on the broader issue of economic inequality and the cultural roots of a good chunk of economic inequality today. And I'll put aside the broader argument, just focus on the poverty issue. I think both of these strategies are going towards trying to figure out some way to use public policy to catalyze cultural renewal or cultural change. Here in America today, and this is the point I was making in the piece, that poverty used to be just the human condition. That's, most people were poor. You didn't have to explain it. That's the way things were.
Yeah.
Then it was largely thought of as, you know, being in underdeveloped areas, rural poverty, and now we have this kind of poverty that is in the inner cities. And that is associated with, not with sort of material deficits, although those certainly exist, but those don't seem to be the fundamental root. What seems to be the fundamental root are kind of cultural or sociological deficits or pathologies of these, you know, just if you boil things down to sort of three basics, people who drop out of high school, who have children too early and outside of marriage, and who, you know, can't get and hold even a low-skilled, low-paying job, those people are more or less doomed these days, and there is that's not I caught a fair amount of predictable grief for pointing these things out, but it's in no way to point these things out and to come to grips with them. There's no way blaming the victim if you were raised in this universe where everybody around you is modeling these dysfunctional behaviors, and everything that's coming into you from the outside world is you know, instructing you in despair and hopelessness and passivity about your capacity to influence your fate, then by the time you are a responsible adult, you know, unless you're just a really exceptional human being to break through from the gravitational hold of this, then you know, you're caught up in it. The question then is whether this cultural change can be facilitated by getting people out of that, you know, sort of reducing the gravitational attraction of pathological culture by getting people away from it, so they're encountering, you know, mixed groups of folks, or is the real cure to just take things head on and go into these areas that are blighted by an ethos that just isn't suited to thriving and flourishing, and get solve things at ground zero. I don't think anybody has their hands on whether one approach or the other is more likely to succeed.
Yeah, it's not the kind of thing that lends itself to, you know, experimental evidence. I do think that there's, in what you're saying and describing your piece, there's an important point here to bring out, and it's connected to something that we can talk about later on in connection with discussions about high levels of imprisonment, which is not unrelated to this issue, which is, there is a kind of basic, political, philosophical point about a kind of division of responsibility. You've said before in our conversations, and I certainly agree with this, that, ideas about individual responsibility are really fundamental. You've emphasized their importance in American culture, I'd say much more generally. I don't think this is a peculiarity of American culture, although there is a distinctive twist on an American culture. But, you know, the idea of people having some kind of responsibility for making a success of their lives is, a very fundamental moral idea. There's another idea, though, which is there's a collective responsibility, you know, a common responsibility for providing people with decent, acceptable, reasonable conditions in which they can try to make something of their lives. And I think one of the things that concerns me about some of what you said, although I think you eventually, you qualified this. One of the things that concerns me is that if we emphasize these points about individual responsibility, you know, you're screwing up, you better do something different. And the other side of this is the person who says, look, I'm screwing up, you know, I'm not doing anything real good. I am doing stuff like people in my neighborhood.
Yes.
But there's another side to this, which is what you've done is you collectively, through law and public policy and history and tradition,
yes,
you've put me in a position where doing this kind of stuff looks like the sensible thing to do. Of course, there are going to be extraordinary people who break free from it, but most of us are not that extraordinary.
Right.
You put me in circumstances where this is what a reasonable and rational adult is going to do. And I guess what I think on the public policy side is that one possibility, and who knows if this is right or wrong, but I think something that I feel tempted to is that let the first step in moving forward on this be an affirmation that there is a collective responsibility to ensure that everybody faces fair, reasonable, decent conditions for making something of their lives, and not just talk about how, you know, heroic individuals, even under the most straitened circumstances, can do something. That's a failure of responsibility, not a failure of individual responsibility, but a failure of the collective responsibility of the citizens in a democratic society.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to suggest that I'm, endorsing a kind of let them eat cake view of people who are at the bottom. On the contrary, I think that for understandable political reasons, we have a shameful and foolish misguidance of our focus on non-problems and where we should be focusing on real problems. And the fact that in this, so I think a lot of the debate about measured income inequality, as I talk about in this piece, is grinding an ideological axe to try to make the middle class feel like they're not doing well under the current economic leadership and they need a change, and this is evidence that things are going wrong and therefore that you need new leadership. And of course that kind of political gamesmanship is just par for the course. But there's a general sustained effort on both sides, whoever the outs are, to make the middle class feel like they're victimized and on the verge of ruin, when in fact this is just the most materially blessed group of people in all of human history. And of course we want our economy to be doing well, and of course we want a healthcare financing system that's rational. But just because things are really good doesn't mean we shouldn't be striving to make them better. We ought to have some sense of perspective. And the fact is that middle class Americans have wonderful, wonderful lives compared to those of everybody else, or most people else on the planet, and compared to most people in history, and in particular compared to our relatively, painfully large, but then relatively small fraction of the American population that's trapped in this black hole of hopelessness and isolation from the community of being productive and contributing members of society. So I think it's a real public policy issue. It's right at the top of my list of things that's wrong with this country. And I think we have moved from a mid-60s mentality, which I would sort of compare to the mentality of the surge. We've got a big problem, and something dramatic and bold and decisive ought to be done about it, and so we'll do it, and then it doesn't work out very well. So just sort of simple-minded urgings of collective responsibility and huge government activism without thinking through the fact that it's really devilishly difficult can just make things worse and can discredit the whole enterprise of trying to make things better. Yeah. So I think we have learned a lot in the past generation. At least the people who are studying these issues have learned that this is a really complicated issue, that it's not just a problem of getting more money into the hands of people who don't have high incomes. It's a problem of developing it is a problem of cultures, that so that kids can be raised in a world where they think like we do, that they think they have the opportunities we do, that they have the resources, and both material and cultural, to make the most out of their lives and take advantage of the enormous opportunities that our incredibly rich country affords to most of us. And on this point, I think that, you know, education, and particularly the abysmal state of inner city public schools, is a you know, prime subject. The issue of public housing policy and whether people ought to be moved into other socioeconomic areas is a legitimate question, and then a big question that almost nobody pays attention to, although it's huge, is the fact that we've got a real concentration of people at the bottom residentially these days. That is 2 million people in prison. It's a shocking number. The incarceration rates in this country are right near the top of the world, and much higher than a lot of places that we think of as sort of barbarous. And it's an astonishing state of affairs. While I believe we ought to be protecting ourselves from violent criminals, a lot of the people in prison today are not violent criminals. We are taking people who are sort of small-time offenders, often just drug offenders, and acculturating them into being predators when they come out, because they can't be anything else. They've been once they are warehoused there for a while, and once they come back out into the system, there's very little chance they're going to do anything other than pursue a life of crime. So that's a huge part of the puzzle, and I know it's again something that you've touched on just recently in Boston Review.
Yeah, I'll just say something about that. I mean, I just briefly. Mindless invocations of collective responsibility.
I mean,
you can go in for mindless invocations of collective responsibility and mindless invocations of individual responsibility as well. And the problem is that you have to go into this prepared to acknowledging that nobody really knows how to succeed at addressing this problem, but that it is, as you say, a problem of extraordinary magnitude. And I think I'd be a little bit cautious on it's absolutely right to say very important for people who live in the top 99.99% of how humans have lived in the history of the world and how people live on the planet now to appreciate that that's true about their circumstances. It's also true that places that have done reasonably well at addressing problems of both poverty and inequality have typically done so not by singling out the poor as a group that needs special programs, but by having more generic, more universal programs, because the political base of support for programs that are specifically beneficial to the poor is much smaller and weaker than programs that benefit the poor and the middle class as well. We're all in this together. Everybody benefits from this.
Yes.
Now, there's a deficiency there, and I know you're concerned about this, which is you think, you know, you end up wasting a lot of money on people who don't need it. The problem is the political logic of entitlement programs or social programs, policy programs that are focused on a discrete constituency of the poor is that it's very hard to sustain them. That does seem to me to be a lesson that we've learned from comparative politics.
Yeah, I understand the political logic of universal programs, but the fact is they worked a lot better when the main problem of being poor was not having enough money. When you could cut checks to everybody and therefore, you know, lift a lot of senior citizens out of poverty through Social Security, then you could both achieve your political goals and achieve some substantive policy goals. But what we've got now is a situation where I don't think cutting checks is anything close to being the right answer. I don't know how you universalize the kinds of public policies that might be useful in addressing the intractable problems of.
Well, we can have a conversation about health, about health and education. You mentioned prisons.
I think that's a big chunk.
It is. So I'm going to hold up for the camera this is the cover of the latest Boston Review, which has an article by Glenn Lowry, the economist. Who's now at Brown, called "Why Are So Many Americans in Prison?" There are also pictures of a bunch of butterflies on the cover. You, of course, can't see this, but the butterfly pictures have the name of Nabokov at the bottom of them. There's an article, a very nice article in here by Roger Boylan, who's a writer, on Nabokov, and among other things. And Nabokov was a butterfly, a lepidopterist.
Yes.
He was a butterfly collector. And these are pictures of Nabokov's butterfly collection from Cornell, where he left them. It's a very beautiful design. Anyway, but the lead article is by Glenn Lowry, which is about this really terrible problem that you were just describing the dimensions of, about the existence of very, very large numbers of people in prison. And there really, I guess there are... 4 points in Glenn's article. First of all, as you say, aside from the fact that the proportions of people in prison are just staggeringly larger than any other place in the world, lots of the people who are in prison are not violent offenders. This is
right.
We've talked about this before. There's a lot of drug imprisonment. Secondly, and actually this is a place where Glenn's article does disagree with something that you say, really only in passing, but you do say in your book, I should also hold that up for the camera,
spare you
the opportunity, Age of Abundance. I'm holding it up so readers can see that it's underlined, pages folded. I've read it with
Excellent.
Great interest. I really recommend it. It's a very... it's a very interesting and enjoyable book to read.
Thank you.
It's really good. But you mentioned at one point in the thing that what happened over the course of the 90s is numbers of people in prison were going up and up and up. Crime was going down and down and down. Down.
Yes.
And, one theory... And it's one that you suggest that you endorse and Glenn criticizes. One theory is that there's a relationship between these two. Basically, what you got was a bunch of hoodlums off the street and you made the costs of criminal activity higher. And imprisonment really was a very successful crime control policy. Well, this is something that people have tried to study. And there are some people who think that about 5% of the crime reduction is due to imprisonment. There's an outside, as far as I understand, it's not a problem I've studied, but from what I know, there's an outside estimate. I think this is Steve Levitt's estimate, the Freakonomics guy. Maybe 25 is up as high as 25% of the crime, of the decline in crime is a consequence of imprisonment. But large numbers of people are being imprisoned for reasons that have nothing to do with rational and successful crime control policy. So you've got a lot of people in prison. It's not about violent crime. A lot of it has to do with drugs.
Yes.
It's not a successful crime control story. Glenn's story is really that it's about a shift in the American polity in a more punitive direction. What that means is that the probability of what is punitive means is a probability of ending up in jail if you are a bad guy who got convicted of doing, well, whether you're a bad guy or not, if you get convicted of doing, probability of ending up in jail goes up a lot. It's really an increase in punitiveness, which he associates with issues
not only
about
race. Not only the probability of going to jail if you're arrested, but then the length of time you spend in jail. Both
That's
of those
right.
have gone up.
The probability of going, the length of time that you go to jail, and then, as we know, recidivism rates are really high, so the
Yes.
probability of visiting the prison a few more times goes up as well, and it's, again, as Glenn emphasizes, it's not real good for other aspects of your life, like holding a job and having a stable family, et cetera, et cetera. This is a bad business. So his story about it is punitiveness tied to issues about race. Yeah, because, of course, it is also true that the population in prison is very, very heavily of color. Though not the proportion of people who are guilty of violent crimes. So it's really this drug race imprisonment issue is an important part of the story. And the last piece of this, and this goes back to the previous conversation that we were having, is that he emphasizes this point that we shouldn't turn this just into an issue about individual responsibility. Of course, individuals are responsible. If they do something bad, they've got to pay some consequences for doing that. But we also have to understand that the people who are being put in prison are not them. They're us. They're part of our political community. And that as you were saying before, that a lot of this, you know, bad hoodlum activity, some of it pretty bad for other people, is a consequence of being in circumstances where you think, like, this is the thing to do. And so there is a joint collective responsibility, a common responsibility, if you don't like collective, a common responsibility to make sure that people are not put in circumstances in which the sensible, reasonable, rational thing to do is to, you know, hold somebody up, beat somebody up, you know, rob, steal, and commit mayhem. And so there's a... so it's... what you do, you know, one of the things that was when Glenn gave this set of lectures here at Stanford, and people said to him, so what are we supposed to do about this? And he said, hey, I don't know. I mean, this is a serious, very smart guy. And what he was saying is, you know, I'm trying to get a conversation started by making sure that people understand the dimensions of this problem, the racial dimensions of the problem, the punitiveness, the exclusion of people from the community, that this is our responsibility, that we're doing something wrong, not just the hoodlums. And now, once we can get the conversation started, as you said with the poverty thing, important issue, let's have a conversation. Right. Let's get the conversation, and not pretend, though, that we know what to do about it.
Yeah, right. Well, just to circle back to... But I always want to circle back to my book. No, but I know the passage you're talking about, where I mentioned the falling crime rates and rising incarceration in tandem in the 90s. Yeah. And two things. First, you know, if you're lucky, you're always learning new things, which means that that any sort of time you froze what you knew at a particular time in print, then you're going to go back and find things you wish you'd said differently. And I may have actually, there was more to say on that point than I said in that sentence or two. But I will say that the punitiveness reaction didn't come out of nowhere. It wasn't just, you know, born of spite or malice or heartlessness. It was born out of reaction to a truly phenomenal and highly destructive explosion in crime rates from the 60s through the early 90s. A huge explosion between 65 and 80, and then it paused for a while, and then it went up again in the late 80s and early 90s, and then then it started plummeting. But during that initial 10 or 15 years of crime explosion, I think it's fairly clear that this crime explosion went in hand with, there's a lot of other things going on, but one thing that was going on was a real fall off in seriousness of law enforcement, that the percentage of crimes that resulted in arrests went way down, and the percentage of arrests that resulted in imprisonment for violent crimes went way down. So the incentive structure changed, and people responded accordingly. And so, to the this was a huge issue for all Americans. The idea that the streets weren't safe, and you had to have all these locks on your doors, and occasional stream of horror stories about people you knew that had been subject to these things, or your own personal experiences, and of course, in the inner city, monstrously high levels of crime. It was a big, serious problem, and it's not too surprising, I think, that public policy, the let's see, thermostat isn't very good, and so while we did some right things, we have new techniques of policing that are better, and we have, I think, gotten more appropriately serious about putting violent offenders, you know, where they can't hurt us. We seem to have, done a lot of things that that weren't necessary as well, and in particular, the big escalation of the drug war, which I think is was misguided from word go, and which really feeds into perpetuating and exacerbating this culture of crime and poverty and pathology and dysfunction. That if you you've got a bunch of suburbanites who want to score some weed or something else or meth, and the place they go is into the inner city. That's where the sellers are, and so and they're the people who end up in jail all the time,
right?
Because the dumb laws are creating black markets, and the black markets tend to favor people who are, are economically marginal to run them. And then the huge crackdown and the vast majority of the incarcerations and the punitive incarcerations are on people at the bottom of the socioeconomic scale and people with the wrong skin color. Then that all adds up to chucking these people into the maw of this horrible system, and whenever they come out of it, they're ruined, and it ruins the lives of the people around them, and it's just, it's a terrible wrong move. So I would say that you don't have to be you can have a fairly modest view of collective responsibility, and as a libertarian, I have a more stringent view of it than you do, and yet think that as a libertarian, I can think that there are that some of my hobby horses are ones that are most justified and have the strongest case for them when you're thinking about the poverty problem. First, doing something about shaking up the dilapidated school systems in inner cities, I would say through a school choice program in those areas. And secondly, ending this insane drug war, which is just breeding criminals.
Yeah.
And therefore breeding poverty.
Right. I think one of the... When I say, I just underscore a point of agreement here. When I say collective responsibility, what I mean is something that that you, as a libertarian, I'd say as a classical liberal, have no trouble with. We disagree about the scope of collective responsibility, but I don't want to. But I think it's a real mistake to think that the very idea of collective responsibility is an idea that belongs to one part or another.
No, that's right. We both think these are matters of public and common concern, and we may have differences on
what the scope of that is. Absolutely,
what instrumentalities will make things better.
That's right. I do want to say that Glenn. I'm speaking on behalf of Glenn, but I think I'm probably agree with this that he wouldn't want to disagree with what you said about the increase in punitiveness being in some ways a response to this is the era of drive-by shootings and crack cocaine,
right.
I mean the end of the period, not the 65 to 80, but the later period, drive-by shootings, crack cocaine, pretty bad
and
stuff.
And all
going
these prophecies
on.
Of super predators, remember?
This is John DiIulio.
I mean, there was no reason to think things were going to start getting better in the early 90s. It looked like they were just going to get worse and worse and worse.
Right. There is a remark that Glenn quotes exactly on this point. DiIulio, who was the super predator guy.
Right.
Who eventually, for about 6 months, ran the faith-based initiatives in the Bush administration and then quit and said, these guys are full of it.
Yes.
He wrote a piece, you probably know this piece, that was in the Wall Street Journal. This is at the end of the 90s, and the piece was called 2 Million Prisoners Are Enough.
Yeah.
So DiIulio is, has been on this. He's a, serious person. I mean, not that I agree with him on a bunch of things, but he's somebody who's very serious. He invented the term super predator in the early 90s. There was one in 96, there was one person who was predicting that there would be a bloodbath of juvenile homicides in 2005 because of the super predator problem. And that really turned out to be wrong. But one of the things that Glenn also emphasizes, aside from this rational response to this outbreak of crime, there are two overlays. One is the one that you mentioned about the drug issue. And I think we're on the same side on the drug issue. Yeah. The other one that he emphasizes, and he says, look, this is speculation. He draws on the work of a woman, Vesla May Weaver, who's just gone to University of Virginia in the political science department, just finished a Harvard PhD thesis on this. He draws on her work, and what she points out is that what happens through the 70s is that there is a kind of, you get a bunch of people who lost on the civil rights movement. They lost the battle on civil rights. Southern whites, for example, and the George Wallaces of the world, and they're looking for new issues, and they can't come out in the same way and say that they're defending racial apartheid. So what they do is they find a bunch of new issues that they push back on. Crime is one, and attitudes towards welfare and the welfare state is another one. So what she's saying, which her argument that Glenn sort of endorses, although again, emphasizing that it's speculative, is that the shift in punitiveness also was facilitated by the fact that there was a political push coming from people who had lost on the civil rights movement and who were looking for some other way to maintain, a racially unequal system, and also people who would think, well, listen, it's not my, I'm the suburban guy. I smoked a bunch of weed when I was a kid. My kid's smoking weed. I don't want my kid to be smoking weed because he's going to lose out in the economic competition to some kid from Mumbai. So what I'm going to do is go and get that, black or Hispanic guy who's been selling him the weed. Yes. To stop doing it. So because it's somebody else who
right.
is the punishment is going to be visited on.
Yeah,
and your kid.
I found this part of the piece the weakest piece, weakest part, and just because it's as if the crime issue were a manufactured kind of smokescreen for continued but now sub rosa racism.
Yeah.
But I'm just afraid it wasn't. It was a real phenomenon.
Yeah.
It was a huge phenomenon, and I think it. I think the fact that the right, that it fell into their lap. I don't think they had to go scrounge it up. It fell into their lap. I mean, it is an immense tragedy that first, a week after the Voting Rights Act was signed, Watts went up in flames, and then for the next three summers after that, one city after another went up in flames in race riots, and then. Once those sort of spectacular conflagrations died down, we just had this ongoing huge explosion in street crime, and a disproportionate percentage of the offenders were people in the inner city and people of color, and those were real facts.
Yeah.
And when liberals were tempted to dismiss them by the charge that anyone who cared about crime was a racist, then I think that attitude helped, give the issue to the right and was a major part of Nixon's law and order style victories. And then, through the 70s, the continued rise of the socially conservative right was that they took crime seriously and liberals were seen as making excuses for it. Fortunately, we're in a much better situation right now. For reasons none of us really has a very good handle on, crime has gotten more manageable, which means that we are at least in a space where we ought to be able to take a more clear-eyed look at the responses we've made, including this I think, a fairly scandalous over-incarceration.
I mean, I think I would put I'm sympathetic with the point that you make that there's a kind of softness in that part of the argument, and I think Glenn is aware of that. He says, as I mentioned, this is sort of speculative. He acknowledges that it's speculative. This is a guy who's, a serious economist. He pays a lot of attention to evidence and argument. Then he knows that this is. But I think what he would say is that maybe this is just what I not only would say but I am saying is that. it's true that there was a real problem. What made the solution to, it made the solution to the problem, the throw everybody in prison, throw drug dealers in prison, the super incarceration response to the problem was easier to adopt.
Because it was them. Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
I think that's an important part of the thing, and I think it's just it's an issue that we have to be that we, including them as part of us, you know, we're all whatever. It's an issue that we have to be sensitive to now. I think that's an important part of what he's saying. We don't have much time left, but there was something that I was struck by in your book that I wanted to. Maybe this is another ill-considered sentence. I should say on that point about. I was surprised that you took the position that you did. I didn't think it went to the heart of your view. I didn't think this somehow revealed that there was some deep difficulty in your view. I think it's, you know, we, as you say, we learn, and there are some deep problems, and then there are some things, well, you could have said something different. That was one where you could have said something different. Here's another one which I was very struck by. This is, just to show you, I read page 155. I'm holding the book up. I've got it underlined. You say both the civil... I was really struck by this. It seems really wrong-headed to me. Both the civil rights movement and the drug culture were outgrowths of the logic of mass affluence. In a society devoted to self-expression and personal fulfillment, African Americans found their second-class status intolerable and latched on to resistance as their own path to self-realization. I think you're pressing your Maslow self-realization theory a little... too hard there.
Yeah.
There are some political movements, and I think the civil rights movement is a good example. I also think the women's movement, in movement for women's suffrage in the earlier part of the century as well, the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, the labor movement, these are not about self-realization. Now, they're really about establishing some kind of basic public equality between people. And so there's another impulse that's at work here other than the impulse to self-realization. I think it's a mistake to say that this was a response to mass affluence because I think the timing is a little off on the civil rights movement. I'm a little unclear in your argument about when mass affluence kicks in, but anyway, I think that the timing is a little off. But it's also true that if you look at all of those, this is the kind of the polemical edge of the point that I want to make, but I think it's something that I'm very interested in knowing what you said. If you look at the movements that I mentioned, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, anti-apartheid, movement for women's suffrage, the movement for the abolition of the slave trade and slavery, the labor movement, in not one of these cases were the great heroes of libertarianism on board.
Yes.
And that's, I think it's, and maybe it's, yeah, well, I'd be interested in knowing what you think about that.
Okay, well, first, in my defense, I these sentences I did not write lightly, so but in my defense, you know, I'm offering a sort of a big picture synthesis of predominantly post-war American history, and in the full realization that of the umpteen trillion data points of experience over these, you know, decades, any one narrative is going to leave a lot of stuff out and torture some stuff at the margins. But it would be silly to assume that there's this one thing, mass affluence, that explains everything in American history, and or that any of the phenomena that it does influence, that it's 100% influence over those events. So in the civil rights movement in particular, there's a lot going on, but what I did want to bring to light was that economic development and the cultural development that went along with that economic development played, I think, a significant role. So why in 1955 did black people in Montgomery decide they weren't going to take it anymore when Rosa Parks was put in jail for refusing to give up her seat? What critical mass had happened so that right then black folks decided they weren't going to take it anymore. They were going to make a stand. They were going to act as if they lived in a world where they had the full dignity that they believed they were entitled to. Why not before? And what happened then? I think there are a number of important things that were going on that in which there is a connection between the progress of capitalism and what happened. First, without a doubt, the mechanization of agriculture that really took off in the 40s pushed a lot of black people off the land, and destroyed the whole sharecropping system, shoved a lot of, you know, millions of blacks into the urban north, where they became constituency for liberal democratic politicians who were sympathetic to ending segregation. It pushed many more into towns and cities in the south, like Montgomery, where instead of being in little isolated shacks on plantations, they were in big cities where they could actually have some possibility of organizing collectively for self-advancement, as they did in the Montgomery bus boycott, as they did in many other civil rights actions from that point forward. So meanwhile, as they were taking their destiny into their own hands, a new technology of mass affluence, television, was bringing their struggles into everybody's living rooms and pricking the conscience of white people to see just how, you know, truly black and white these moral issues were. So all of that was going on. Then the broader point that I was making here, and that you think is a stretch, but I don't think it's entirely a stretch, is that, and this is a dynamic playing out over a longer period of time from, I would say, from the kind of Gilded Age forward in middle class existence, you have, as people kind of get off the farm and get off of a, you know, self-sufficiency kind of economy, and then and, you know, take the next step up Maslow's pyramid, they start thinking about not just about survival, but they start thinking about dignity and self-respect, and they start thinking about self-realization. And for blacks, of course, this was thwarted terribly, and and because they were just held down, and not just held down through laws and through oppressive customs, but held down through psychologically by being living in a culture that denigrated them and that influenced them to think of themselves as second-class citizens and denied them their own, you know, self-respect. And in I quote from the Souls of Black Folk about this kind of double consciousness. That was the problem that
Du Bois
mentioned, that blacks not only see themselves as they see themselves, but as white people see them. And so they have this always in their minds, this image of themselves as inferior. And that attack on their self-respect was as bad as anything that was going on in their lives. And when there's another thing I quote, there's a piece that Bayard Rustin Ghost wrote, I think, for Martin Luther King, but it was under King's byline, about interpreting the Montgomery bus boycott in particular, that blacks were refusing to buy into this anymore, that they were going to insist upon self-respect and insist on being treated as full-fledged human beings. That is, they were going to insist on their dignity. They weren't going to just deal with survival anymore. They wanted the next thing. And so living in a culture of the 50s where everybody's going out and getting theirs and the American dream is just in, you know, full tilt and everybody's talking about making the most of their lives, and there's this ethos of pursuit, full throttle pursuit of personal fulfillment in suburbia, then it had to be all the crueler for blacks to feel that they were being excluded from this. So I'll stick by it.
Here's a different story.
Of course, there's a lot more going on, but I think that's going on too.
Yeah. So, I mean, a different story is, you know, the Myrdal story, of the American Dilemma story, which is, you know, this point about being treated with respect. Absolutely. Dignity, absolutely. There is a basic conflict between the second-class status as a matter of law and policy and culture in racial inequality in the United States, between that and the fundamental promise of the not so much of the Constitution, but of the more fundamental American document, the Declaration of Independence, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that we're all created equal.
Correct.
But I guess what I'm emphasizing is that this is really about equal standing. It's resistance to subordination. It's resistance to being treated as a no count, resistance to being treated as somebody whose worth is less than somebody else, and resistance to being treated that way as a matter of fundamental law and policy. I'm all for self fulfillment. I try to even have some of it in my own life. Just seems to me that I think there's another story about this, which is the kind of thing that I think King did emphasize. It's what King had in mind when he said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it's turned toward justice. He picked that phrase up from the abolitionist Unitarian Theodore Parker, not somebody who was talking about self-fulfillment. The arc of the moral universe is long, it's turned toward justice. It's really about the fundamental entitlement of people as a matter of political morality and as a matter of the basic founding principle of the country, both, to being treated as equals. So
I will just grant that there is something qualitatively different about a struggle against oppression as opposed to a struggle for self-realization. Yeah. One is overcoming a deficit and an injustice. The other is trying to get to heighten your surplus. But nonetheless, there is an element of this quest for dignity and for self gratification that is a continuum between them. The people who broke out of the conformity of organization man corporate culture and set out on their own to found Silicon Valley in the 50s. I don't want to trivialize the civil rights movement by saying they're the same thing. They're not the same thing, but there are common elements in them. This desire to assert yourself and to not to not debase yourself to either a corporate hierarchy or to a racial hierarchy, that kind of anti-authoritarianism was in the air, and it was expressing itself in a whole bunch of different ways, and some of them sublime, some of them silly, that was the big picture point I was trying to make.
Yeah, I don't think I want to disagree with that exactly. I do think that there's a continuum here, and that one of the things there are many things that are disturbing about being treated in public life as a subordinate, as an unequal, and among them is there's an insult to your dignity. There's also a restraint on your capacity to, make something of your life and make something of your life in the way that other people are as well.
Right.
And I think this is where I do think that the people who've said that there's a fundamental division between the struggles of the civil rights movement against racial inequality and the political fights of gays and lesbians for recognition as equals, and who've said that there's a kind of trivialization of the civil rights movement by saying that. I disagree with that, and I think we're on the same side on that one. I just want to make sure that we keep this equality picture in play and say that it must be, a concern for you that there was an absence of the kind of libertarianism.
Yeah, that was something that really, I came to dwell on in writing this book, and that I wanted to emphasize in this book that I'm talking about how this kind of new, more libertarian social order, one that's more culturally open than the pre-60s era, and one that's more economically competitive and entrepreneurial than the pre-60s era, how this social order came to be, and a lot of it didn't have anything to do with people who thought of themselves as libertarian or small government types doing things. A lot of it came from folks who had very unlibertarian ways of thinking about things, but that ultimately or that pursued means that libertarians, strict principled libertarians, will take umbrage at. But but pursuing ends that are very conducive to the libertarian worldview of individual dignity. And so, of course, libertarians who took a very strict view of property rights, couldn't stomach the public accommodations rules of the civil rights laws, and so found themselves in company with just, unreconstructed racists. And likewise, in their view of support for freedom of contract and freedom of association, didn't like a lot of the anti-discrimination legislation passed in the name of feminism, but were very sympathetic with the substantive view that a woman has the right to pursue her way in the public realm every bit as much as a man does. So there is that tension between men's means and ends is one that I didn't want to shirk or skirt.
And I think I really
plunge right into telling the story.
Yeah, no, I think it's one of the things that I made a list of in the back and for myself. I hold it up to the camera. People can see I made some notes in the back of it. And there was the first things on the list were some of the things that I admired about the book. And one of the first thing on the list of on my list is that you acknowledge the importance of mass politics in creating this, what you think of as a world that's more conducive to the kind of capacious libertarianism that you endorse. But you don't tell the story. It's not exclusively a story about that resulting from some kind of iron economic logic of mass prosperity. It's produced by people engaging in mass politics, I don't think there's any effort to deny this, engaging in mass politics, as you were just saying, animated by principles and ideals that, at least on the surface, and maybe even a few steps down, don't seem congenial to at least to classical liberalism or the kind of libertarianism you endorse.
There's a difference between one's present day forward focused perspective and the luxury of the historical perspective. And when you get to take, and I must admit, I find the historical perspective much more psychologically congenial because you've got hindsight, and you can see how the story turned out, and you can sort of enjoy the ironies of people trying to accomplish one thing and something else completely turning out. I think there's just a lot of irony in the story I tell, it's a cool world that things turn out so unexpectedly.
Right. Just the last thing that I'll just want to say is we should break up here is that on this issue about the importance of being treated with respect and being treated with respect as an equal and the consequences of that idea for, public life in a, democratic society. I mean, I think, this is kind of philosophical observation, that a way of describing the great achievement of John Rawls's book, A Theory of Justice, was he argues, this is how I see his argument, is what he says is the same idea of political morality, about being treated with respect in public life as an equal, that same idea that underlies our commitment to political liberty and religious liberty and civil liberties, all that very same idea commits us to a demanding standard of equality of opportunity where people are not held back by the circumstances of their birth and upbringing, and also a kind of economic egalitarianism. So the idea that there's a fundamental moral idea that is a common ground between the classical liberals and the more more egalitarians, the great achievement in A Theory of Justice was to try to show, and I wouldn't say it's successful, but it's great, the effort is to really to try to show how that idea commits us to a more expansive and a more egalitarian form of liberalism than classical liberals are prepared to endorse.
Yeah, well, I certainly understand that's your point of view, and that opens up a gigantic can of worms. But I think
for next time,
in our spirit of dwelling on respect and dignity, that we're going to show respect for the dignity of our viewers and not ramble on any more today.
Good.
And we've got to wind this up.
All right, good to talk. As